Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Delta Flyers Journey Through the Wormhole with Quark, Dax, and their good friends, Tom and Harry. Join us as we make our way through episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
For the complete and exciting, amazing, incredible, stupendous version of this podcast, please check us out at patreon.com/TheDeltaFlyers and sign up to become a patron today.
Your hosts for today are my fellow Trek actors, Terry Farrell, Robert Duncan McNeil, and myself, Garrett Wong. And today we have a very special, special guest joining us, writer extraordinaire Robert Hewitt Wolf.
Woohoo!
Yay!
Fun to be here.
Okay, just I need to ask the first question right off the bat for you, yes. Robert Hewitt Wolf. Please just take us just down that little journey of how you became a Deep Space Nine writer, your origin stories for Trek, and we would love to hear that.
Yeah. Sure. So I went to UCLA Film School, actually got a bachelor's and master's in film. And along the way, I got into screenwriting, and I got placed second in this old award thing called the Golden Awards. Uh-huh. And the result of that was you got like your name on the back page of Variety. It was a pretty big deal.
Wow.
So I got an agent off my second script. And then 5 years later, after struggling for a while, my agent was like, hey, we represent one of the writers on Next Generation and they have an open door pitch policy if you watch the show. And I was like, oh, I watched the first season. It was terrible, but I can watch it. I watched it in reruns. So I watched it in reruns and they got me a meeting to pitch, and I went in and I pitched a couple things and struck out, and they invited me a second time and I struck out, and they invited me a third time. I was like, if I don't sell this time, they're never asking me back. And I went in and I pitched, ironically for this, I pitched a time travel story that eventually became Past Tense, sort of.
Oh my God. That's
wow.
Great.
I pitched it all out. And they were like, that's great, but we have a time travel story on stage right now. We're doing Time's Arrow. And I was sitting on the couch in, I think it was Ron's office. And I was pitching like Ron Moore, Renee Echevarria, Brandon Braga, I think Pete Fields and Joe Manosky. It was ridiculous. They were all in there.
Wow.
And I was sitting at the edge of the couch and I was so frustrated. I literally banged my head on the arm of the couch. And I was like, okay, I got this other idea. It's like Worf goes into the holodeck to play Old West with his kid. And there's a thing where Data is plugging into the ship to see if he can be the backup computer of the ship. And it crosses all the wires. And slowly everyone in the holodeck becomes Data. Everyone else in the Western becomes Data. And all the safeties are off. And the only way to end the program is to beat now Data in a gunfight and then kiss barmaid Data. And that's how you end the story. And so they bought it. I was like,
oh. Wow, that's
yay.
And that was a fistful of Data's? Is that what the Data's, episode
And that
became?
Was my first professional sale ever.
Wow.
So then they let me write that episode. God only knows why. I'd almost sold the script. I sold it later a couple times, actually, a feature, and they'd read the feature that I'd almost sold. Like, literally, I was in negotiations in the company I was negotiating with, Carolco. They mm-hmm. did, like, the Terminator movies. They went bankrupt for the second time in the middle of the negotiation. Yeah. But we made an offer. We countered. They went bankrupt. It was awesome. Anyway. So that was my first gig.
Now taxes is 100% free when you file in the TurboTax app if you didn't file with us last year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, just do your own taxes in the app by 2/18.
What if I have lots of forms?
All good, all 100% free.
What if I had three jobs?
Still 100% free.
What if I once saw Bigfoot?
That has nothing to do with taxes, so still 100% free.
Now that's what I'm talking about.
Now this is taxes. See if you qualify in the TurboTax app. Excludes TurboTax Live, must start and file in app by 2/18.
Can I ask you a question about the pitching, though? Because we've heard some other people talk about, outside writer pitches. Mm-hmm. What is the process? Like, if you pitch and they buy it, did they just say, that was a great pitch, go write it? Or do they go into the room and break it? Do you break the story with them? How does that work?
It really depended. Sometimes it went anywhere from there was a way they could just buy a concept. Like if they thought, well, there was like a little nugget in there we liked, but we're not so sure about these writers and, you know, we don't have time to work with them and they're not union. You could just buy, like, you pay them $1,000 for the concept. And they did that a little bit. Next step up would be, okay, you know, like that's, we're legit. We like the entire story. We're still not sure we want you to write the episode, but like we will sit down and talk to you about it for a little bit. You'll write a story document, you know?
Right. And you get paid for that. That's a,
you got paid a bump and up. That was from... story buy. And that was like legit Writers Guild job.
Yeah.
Can I ask, is this, is that like an outline for the whole script? Is that what, at that Star Trek stage?
Yeah, at that stage, it was like a 5 to 6 page, double-spaced, you know, times outline. 12-point story document in prose. It wasn't broken down by scenes.
Okay.
And then if they liked that and they liked the writer and they and we had time, you'd get invited into then actually write the first draft at least. And that, and then you'd be in the story break. And out of the story break, you generate an outline that was broken down scene by scene.
Got it.
Okay.
Then you'd go off to write based on that outline. And then usually as a freelancer, you get cut off because we didn't have time. And then that was it. And then a staff, someone on staff like Brandon rewrote a Fistful of Datas. So that's why we have share credit.
So like you pitched this Fistful of Datas. They said, we love it. We're going to buy the story. So you got story buy. You're at that level.
Yep.
And we want you to write it. So you were in your very first writer's room on Next Gen.
Yeah, my first writer's room that I was ever in, that was a real writer's room, was Michael Pillar, Jerry Taylor, Ron, Renee, Brandon. It was like, great.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for breaking that down.
And then the second writer's room I'm in was Deep Space Nine, because they had me come over to do a freelance on Deep Space Nine. They had me do Q-List. That was a freelance. I wasn't on staff yet. It was another tryout. And that was me and Ira and Michael and Peter Allen Fields. And so again, like great, really smart writers. And so I learned a lot and wrote Q-List, and they liked that enough, even though it didn't turn out that great in the end of the day. I mean, it's all right. It's fine.
Yeah, it's good.
It's fine. They liked that enough. They hired me under staff. And that's how I got on staff.
I saw you in Vegas for a second, but otherwise I haven't really seen you all this time. What have you been working on since Star Trek?
Oh God. I created a syndicated science fiction show that ran for 5 years called Andromeda. I worked on a bunch of other stuff. I created another show called The Dresden Files. It only lasted a season.
That's from the books.
From the books. From, co-developed with Hans, who I worked with on Deep Space. I was on Elementary.
I love that show.
6 seasons. Mm-hmm. So I was
really good. Well done.
Yeah, thanks. And then now I'm on an NBC show called The Irrational, which is Jesse Martin. It's another procedural mystery show where he plays like a college professor who's an expert in irrational human behavior.
I have to watch that Irrationals.
Yeah.
Yeah. And his ex-wife is an FBI agent. He still kind of wants to be part of her life. So he's helping.
I hear Jesse Martin is the nicest man. I hear he's such a good man.
He's a good guy.
Well, it sounds like you've had an incredible career. So congratulations on that.
Congrats.
Lot of really impressive stuff.
Thanks. I've had a good run. You know, my big goal is, again, like this is so inside inside baseball for everybody listening, but my big goal is to try to get 100 writing credits, which is really hard.
Oh, wow.
It is hard. It is hard.
And I'm on like 88 or something like that. So.
Yeah, you'll do it. That's amazing.
Well, I'm trying. We'll see.
A working title for this episode was Cold and Distant Stars. Was that your original working title, I guess, that you had?
Yeah, that was the pretentious version. Yeah. I had a few versions of this show that I kept trying to sell Ira on.
Yes.
And that was the working title of the one that was a little more surreal.
Okay, because would this be the one where Cisco goes back in time and ends up being homeless?
Yeah.
And that he was actually he claims that he's from the future.
Yep.
He was commander of a space station. And because of that, everyone thinks he's insane. He's given Thorazine, which Robbie, it sounds like the Voyager episode of the pilot from the time ship in the 29th century that gets trapped in Venice Beach.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone thinks he's crazy too. So it was like, wow.
Yeah. And then eventually they use some of those ideas in the Far Beyond the Stars, which they were they were going to use my title for. I was like, no, it's my title. I might use it. but so they sort of took the pitch from I think Mark Zucre for Far Beyond the Stars, and they used some elements from my original idea of like the homeless, the crazy, the vision of himself as a starship, or like creating a starship captain, that kind of thing.
Right.
Before we get into this episode any further, I just want to make sure we give a couple shout outs for birthdays.
Yes. Yes.
We've got a couple birthdays this time.
Our first birthday is Heath K, January 28th. Happy birthday, Heath.
Happy birthday, Heath.
Happy birthday, Heath.
Happy birthday, Heath.
All right. Next up, we have Ryan Tomei. 3 days later on January 31st. Happy birthday, Ryan.
Happy birthday, Ryan.
Happy birthday, Ryan.
Happy birthday, Ryan. Also, we want to welcome our newest prophet, Sean T. Welcome, Sean.
Welcome, Sean.
Welcome, Sean.
Welcome, Sean.
It's time for our poetry synopsis. Robbie yes, McNeil, sir. With your limerick, synopsize this episode.
Here we go. Just got to loosen up a little. Okay. Yeah. The transporter doesn't work very well. It's 2024. Tensions are starting to swell. While Dax is drinking fine wine, Sisko tries to save the timeline. He says, call me Bell, Gabriel Bell.
Nice.
Thank you.
Woo. Look at that. Little James Bond kind of
I know.
Action going on at the end. I like that.
I loved that last line.
A little limerick.
Is it his last line?
Yep. It's the last line of the episode.
Right? Yep.
Bell. Call me Bell. Gabriel Bell. Okay.
Had to work that into the poem.
Couldn't stand it, could you? You had to do it again, didn't you?
I did. I like to impersonate him. My haiku for past tense part one, transport malfunction. Jadzia lives the high life. Sisko becomes Bell. There you go.
Nice.
Nice.
Thank
Very
you.
Nice.
Short and simple.
Yeah. Much faster than a 20-minute synopsis.
Yes.
I have a poem.
Do you?
Well, it's not my poem, but I just wanted to. I have the lyrics for Another Day in Paradise by Phil Collins.
Uh-huh.
Just to say that this has been a problem ever since then. So she calls out to the man on the street, sir, can you help me? It's cold and I've nowhere to sleep. Is there somewhere you can tell me? He walks on, doesn't look back. He pretends he can't hear her. Starts to whistle as he crosses the street. Seems embarrassed to be there. Oh, think twice, because it's another day for you and me in paradise.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's very good.
Nice. I couldn't take the time to write my own, so I just stole one.
Hey,
excellent.
We're okay with theft.
I love it. I love that you participated.
Yes, thank you. That's so
thank you. It makes it look better that I didn't do mine this week that you had one. So yay. So I don't feel quite
slack.
So naughty.
Yeah. All right. Well, the story, obviously, by Ira Stephen Bear and Robert Hewitt Wolf. Teleplay by Robert Hewitt Wolf. Directed by Reza Badiyi. I thought he only did that one episode. Clearly he did more than one episode of DS9 then. Yeah.
It's like Reza. Three or four.
Okay. So this is his second one that we've seen so far. Guest stars. We have Jim Metzler as Christopher Brenner, Frank Military as BC, Dick Miller as Vin, Al Rodrigo as Bernardo Calvera, and Tina Lifford as Lee, and also Bill Smitrovich as Webb. These are all names from what are these from again, Robert? They're from something.
They're all from Magnificent Seven.
Thank you.
A lot of them are.
Oh, how great.
Oh, how funny.
For no particular reason, by the way. No reason at all.
Not your favorite film?
You just wanted to.
I love the Magnificent Seven.
Same.
But like, there's no thematic connection. Not really. Right. I mean, I guess it's like people trying to save people from an impossible situation. But it's not like, it's not really a Western. It was just sort of a random, I don't know why I did. We just decided to start naming people after people.
That's
from
fun.
It's fun. Seven, yeah. But we did.
Oh,
I love seeing Dick Miller, by the way.
Yeah.
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 What a great character actor. Yeah.
I mean, that's a great cast. I mean, Frank Military is terrific in it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bill Smith, mm-hmm. Tina Lifford is great. They're all great. All six of the Agreed. Major guests are terrific.
Yeah.
Love Tina Lifford.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She did great.
Oh, she's really so good. Great. Yeah.
We also have some co-stars listed as well. Henry Hayashi is a male guest. Patty Holly is a female guest. Richard Lee Jackson is Danny. Eric Stewart as Stairway Guard. And John Lendale Bennett as Gabriel Bell. John Lendale Bennett was stand-in, stunt double, everything for Avery's character. The episode House of Quark, he was the Klingon that was stabbed in the very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
So he's made it a career of being on camera and getting stabbed so far. So in the prior episode and in this one too. Yeah.
He's very good at dying.
He's good at dying.
Some comes like, no, he's going to die.
Yeah.
You just knew it.
You knew it. All right, Robbie, let us jump into this. Go ahead.
Let's jump into it. Well, we start with a commander's log. Sisko says commander's log stardate 48481.2. He continues, my senior staff and I have been asked to address the annual Starfleet Symposium on the current situation in the Gamma Quadrant. I'm looking forward to the opportunity and to visiting my sister in Portland. I love these commander's logs or whatever, by the way. It's a great way to sort of like quickly set the context of every episode.
It's perfect. Mm-hmm.
That's why I read it when we're talking about these episodes, because it just lays it all out. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a great way to just get through a bunch of exposition. If you can get a little character into there, it's even better. And it's sort of classic voiceover. It's the one time in Star Trek we could sort of do voiceover is if we were doing logs, you know, and voiceover can be great. It just depends on the show if it's a part of it or not. I did that show, The Dresden Files. I did had like hard boiled detective voiceover, which was really fun to write. But this is as close as Star Trek gets to getting to do it that way.
Yeah, I like it
when shows have that. So it really adds to your experience as you're watching, and it fills in blanks that you can't understand. Like when you read a book, you get so much information.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you only have, what did you guys get? Like 42 to 45 minutes at the most?
Somewhere like that.
Yeah. So it's not a lot of time to show the story. Mm-hmm. We were forced to do exposition.
Yeah,
this is
you have to.
I felt so bad for our poor actors on Star Trek. Had to do some terrible exposition.
Sometimes it gets very dense. Oof. Yes,
it does. But then your job is to make it sound as natural as possible.
This is the first time we hear about a sister. We never hear that Avery or that Sisko has a sister. We don't know about that. We hear
sister
about
and Portland. Father, have we talked? We've talked.
No,
no.
First time
we know his dad's a chef.
And do we ever meet her? No, I didn't think we did.
Dad is a chef in New Orleans or something like that. We know that. Yeah. We know he has I think we know he has brothers. I think, if I remember correctly,
he has one brother and two sisters. He comes from a big two sisters, one brother. I think he has a big family, relative to to TV families, which are usually small, but we never see any of them.
No,
never do.
We never met my sister.
No,
I have a sister.
Oh, really? Jadzia has a sister too.
And then Kira had family, but we don't like to talk about what happened to them.
Every time she does, it's like, oh.
Yeah.
It's funny, though, that you throw in the sister. We don't meet her, as we talked about, but it's on theme with family, which is so much about what DS9 is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The fact that, you know, Terry, that you mentioned you've got a sister. I love that everybody talks about their family, even if we don't meet them. It's just important to them. And I think that's a great detail, a great theme that every character is kind of playing into.
That was a big, big focus of Deep Space Nine, was that like, these are like, Sisko is a family man. He has a son. Mm-hmm. He had a wife. he meets his new wife on the show, eventually married. Spoiler alert.
What?
But that was, I think we felt like that was an important difference between Deep Space Nine characters and Next Generation, where everyone was pretty much single, didn't have kids except for Crusher.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have two young people on the show. Eventually we had three. We have, you know, everybody has brothers and sisters and dads, and, you know, we see a few parents over time. In a weird way, like Jadzia has a host of, not Jadzia herself has a sister, but also Dax has an ex-wife that we meet, and like there's all these relationships that Dax has, and we always felt that was really a big part of the show.
Yeah,
we wanted the show to feel like a family, even more so than, in a way, Next Generation.
Yeah,
which felt like a found family for sure, but we pushed it a little harder on Deep Space Nine.
Well, I love that you bring that up right out of the gate in the voiceover before we even see anybody on camera. Mm-hmm. But we do cut on the bridge. They're approaching Earth. They talk about dinner with Admiral Drazman. That sounds like a very fancy dinner, and Sisko, Dax, and Bashir are going to go, but nobody else wants to go on this dinner.
Like, no one seems excited about it.
No, Kira's not interested. Odo's not interested. Miles really doesn't want to go.
What an interesting last name that you gave. That's this Admiral Drazman. It's just so, it's like some type of news type. Yeah, it's
it hurts.
It's like a new medication that you're seeing advertised. Take Drazman if you need,
And the list of side effects are worse than what it
drowsiness is 100%. Drowsiness is definitely a side effect of taking Drazman. It wasn't that Drazman was a bad person.
Right.
But no. Droner Drazman, I believe.
Drazman.
He just kept rambling and rambling. Yeah.
Talks and has this monotone voice and just puts everyone to sleep.
I love it.
Well, Quark also shows up in this scene. He makes a call from the station. This is, I think, Armin's only scene in the episode.
We had to give him his residuals.
His residual scene, exactly.
This is the first episode, Robbie, that does not take place on the station. This is the only time the station is referred to, is this side little black closet in Quark's that he's doing this call from. That's it. Yeah. Other than that, every other scene takes place off of the station. This is the first of four episodes in DS9 that are not on the station.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, Quark calls. He reminds Sisko that, you know, the Negus really helped you guys out, making contact with the Dominion, getting to know them. So the Negus would like a favor. His nephew is being held by Starfleet. Sisko gets the hint about all this. I love that Sisko knows the rules of acquisition, too, that he's quoting the rules.
It's funny.
He studied up.
Yeah. Do you remember about the rules of acquisition? Armin has said that they were just kind of making them up as they went. Is that true?
100%.
Just whatever you need.
Made up both of the ones that are in this scene, we made up for the scene.
For this scene.
That's funny.
So good.
And then did you keep track of them once you had them?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's
eventually
good.
Ira and I did a book called Legends of the Ferengi.
Oh, I've got seriously? Was like
all the rules that we did, not all the rules, because we never did all of them, but every rule that we did, plus a few we made up for the book with a little story about each one.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
cute. It's a great little book. I used to keep it during the podcast right next to me, so when Armin said something, I could look it up, but it's filed away on my bookshelf right now.
As a writer, how do you come up with the different names? Like Negus's nephew, I love this name. Balongo is his name.
I can tell you where that came from.
Yeah, yes.
So it's a very obscure reference to a fantasy role-playing game called RuneQuest, which was one of the big fantasy role-playing games in like the 70s and 80s. It was like an early rival to D&D.
Right.
Uh-huh. And they had a very elaborate, one of the features of RuneQuest was it had a very elaborate mythology with all these different gods. And one of the very minor gods was a trickster god named Balongo. So Balongo. So, So I occasionally would name people or characters in the show after either characters from the mythology of that show,
yeah,
or after my friends' characters in our D&D or RuneQuest games. So there's a couple of characters that are named after my friends' characters or my characters or stuff like that.
Okay, so Blongo is a trickster god, sort of like how Loki is in the
kind of a Loki fire stealer kind of guy. Negus's nephew is clearly a up to no good most of the time, which is why Sisko says you can't free a fish from water, because Belongo is always going to be in trouble. There's no way to get Belongo out of trouble, because Belongo lives in trouble. Like, that is his existence. That's amazing.
That's amazing.
Thank you for that tidbit. All right.
Well, they head over to the transporter room, which for the first time I realized how small that transporter pad is.
That's tiny.
It's tiny. And suddenly O'Brien sees some kind of power fluctuation in the transporter readouts. He fixes it. Doesn't seem phased by it, really. But then he realizes, well, it doesn't look like they made it to their destination.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
Right. But it showed that the transport was complete. So it didn't, you know, they
went somewhere.
Are not scattered somewhere in the universe. They're somewhere. That's all we know.
Yeah.
They went to the Paramount backlot.
Yes.
So many familiar nooks and crannies of that backlot.
Yes.
We head out to the street. There's Sisko lying on the ground. Bashir's right next to him. They are woken up by, looks like a shotgun or something, some kind of weapon prodding them. And it looks like these are cops or security guys in jumpsuits, waking them up, tells them they're in the sanctuary district and that it's 2024.
Mm-hmm.
What?
I know.
Yes.
That's how you know it, they're in the future, because the guards are wearing jumpsuits.
Jumpsuits, exactly. Well, you know what else I noticed? We'll get to the scene, but I didn't expect that when Dax is in the office building and he comes in and goes out through a door, that he has to turn a knob and open a door. And I was like, oh my God, we never see doors getting opened.
Yeah.
Star Trek. Like they're always automatic.
Yeah.
And he pulls it open, pushes it shut. Anyway, these guys, the cops in jumpsuits, pick them up. It's 2024. They're escorted away. And then we see at the bottom of the subway steps, Dax is still unconscious, lying at the bottom of the subway steps.
Uh-oh. But I have my...
Your brooch.
Combat, John. Yep. The brooch.
Yeah, the brooch.
No, my jewelry. I have my jewelry on.
Sisko and Bashir are sprawled out. And then when we see Dax, she's carefully placed on those steps. Just so it's like a beauty shot. She's like,
I'm not going to hairdo.
My hair's perfect. I'm going to lie a certain way. And it was just, of course.
Dax is a cat. Don't you know that? She, if she doesn't land on her feet, she's going to land
in a gracefully position, in a perfect graceful position.
Told you, Gawa. I am a water rabbit, which really is a cat. Yeah. Cats were just superstitiously bad. So
that's right. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
I did love on the back lot. There's a couple of subway stairs on the back lot at Paramount, but they dead end. They don't go anywhere. Because I've shot in that back lot. But they're cool, yeah. But you kind of get down there and you're like, whoa.
Bummer.
We used every inch of those stairs, I think, in that shot. That was it.
I think you did.
I can weirdly remember that.
Can you?
Because the crew was all squished in the back.
Yes, because it's a dead end. Exactly. Yes,
it's very small. Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, we see Dax there at the bottom. We go to the opening credits. We come back, and she's woken up by some nice man helps her.
Nice, handsome man.
Very handsome man. Very well spoken.
I have good luck?
Yes, you really do.
You do.
But you covered very quickly. You were like, oh, my! I still have my brooch. You immediately were like into, you know, conning this guy.
Seven lifetimes. I've got it together, man.
Yes, you were good.
Dax is very good at saying the things that need to be said in a given situation. That was always part of her character. And part of the, I mean, obviously the gag is that Brenner probably wouldn't have helped Sisko and Bashir even if he'd seen them. Be honest. He's not that nice.
No.
He's helping Dax.
Like, yes, exactly.
I mean,
He's helping the ex model.
Yeah.
Yes.
The 5'11", 6 foot tall, beautiful.
Yes. Thank you. I'll take that.
soaking it up. I'm soaking it up.
It was a deliberate choice that it was going to be Dax who was going to be saved by the beneficent billionaire. And meanwhile, Sisko and Bashir, you know, are ending up in the homeless camp. That was not, you know, we didn't pull those names out of a hat.
Can we just say for a second how incredible the storytelling of the future and all of the encampments that we do have now, how homelessness has really exploded over the last 20 or 30 years. And it's sad, but remarkable to watch. And who would have known? I have goosebumps right now because the last time I lived in Los Angeles 2 years ago, it was really scary in Santa Monica, living in Santa Monica. It wasn't the safe place it was in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Really bad. Really bad.
I mean, the truth is, though, that when we told the story, there were encampments and a lot of homeless in Santa Monica. It's gotten worse.
It exploded. Yeah.
But it wasn't not there, you know.
Right.
And that was
hidden more, like under the passes. And now they've taken over, like.
It's tough, man. It's a massive crisis. We've been dealing with it poorly for 40 years now.
Yeah. Well, what's super interesting is that when this episode came out, I think the notes talk about how the LA City Council was voting on actually establishing homeless zones where they were going to fence them in, similar to what the sanctuaries are. So that that was so time, you know, it was so time appropriate or so coincidental that this episode came out at the same time. The way they shot this scene, though, is Brenner actually walks past Dax. You notice that he doesn't stop right in front of her. He's halfway up the stairs when he stops and turns around and realizes, oh, someone's discarding models here, just throwing them away. So let me go back and talk to this person and see if she's okay. So it was very interesting. And so what did you envision this guy to be, though, Robert? Brenner was just this internet guru. What was he exactly that made him?
Was he like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or something?
No, you know who I saw him as? I'll tell you who I think he was. So, but I want to know what
you know, say it and then I'll tell you whether you're right.
To me, just the way he looks and everything, I thought he was Mark Zuckerberg. I thought he was the Facebook because he's red hair guy.
Facebook came after this episode.
Too soon. Yeah.
Yeah. Too soon.
Ted Turner.
Right on.
Yeah, that makes sense because he had Channel 90. Yeah.
It
was like loosely the idea because this is before Zuckerberg. Jobs and I think Jobs was around, but like he wasn't as big in a way.
Yeah.
And Gates was, you know, around.
But Ted Turner was in your face. Yeah. Yeah, and he was
media mogul,
spokesperson for himself. Yeah.
Basically. And the idea of like a guy who ultimately like did a lot of good things too, but you know, was still a billionaire who controlled a media company. So that was sort of where we were going for.
Got it.
That was the very, very general prototype. Was Ted Turner back then.
I just love that comment when you introduce the names. Chris goes, oh, Gen Z, that's a pretty name. What is that, Dutch? I just love that. Dutch? And Dax is like, yeah, something
actually,
like that.
Actually, isn't it Polish?
It's Polish.
And it means warrior.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know
didn't
that.
Have
I
great
never
writers, you guys.
Didn't Terry, why didn't you
writers?
Tell us this before? You've never
I think
told
I
us
have.
This.
It's
Polish?
Haven't I?
I don't
no.
think. No, you've never told
okay,
us.
Okay, well,
that
let me
warrior.
Tell you. It's Polish, and it means warrior.
Thank you.
And I think it's a family name from Michael Piller's family. I think he...
Really?
Oh.
Yeah, believe so. Curzon's a street in Los Angeles, but...
it is
a family name for Michael Piller. But
am I right? Did he create Dax, Michael Piller?
I mean,
mostly?
You know, it's credited to him and Rick
to begin with.
Yes. Yeah.
To begin with. But you guys really made it happen for me because I'm not exactly how they wanted
the original,
me to be.
Right. We made adjustments. We all grew the character together.
But that happens on every show.
I think that the truth is, like, Dax took the biggest evolution from concept to execution and eventual where we ended up, because the original character was supposed to be much more kind of like Zen philosopher Yoda-esque and like super scientist spouting technobabble all day long. And then we got Terry, who is lovely and completely different from that in the cast. And we were like, we should maybe make the character more of a rogue, more of a
yes,
trickster.
I was very physical.
but also just like charming, much more charming, honestly, and much more engaging than like some sort of Zen master mentor to Sisko. Mm-hmm. And also just like more playful. So we definitely moved to the sort of like rogue. This is the best way to put it. Roguish mm-hmm. character who is much more of a little bit more of a trickster, which is why Dax can just sort of like
jump right into the cover.
Jump right
into
a situation and just be like, all right, I'm going to start tap dancing now, and I won't stop until I have to. You know.
Yeah.
And that was basically the character by then. And I think by this time we'd all, you know, with Terry's wonderful contribution, we'd all come to a really good place with the character.
Thank you. Well, thank you giving me so many great things to do, because it was really fun.
I've told this to other actors, but basically if you are an actor on a show and you get more to do and more fun things to do, that's how you know the writers like you.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
And trust you also.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, I said this to Aaron back in the day. Like, Aaron's character could have been completely just like barely there. Like, he would have just been the bad boy best friend. But like, Aaron was a talented actor, and so hey, he got to do a whole bunch more stuff than anyone I would have ever imagined.
Yeah.
Terry helped us make this character into somebody who we could do all this really fun stuff and the physical stuff and the charm and all that stuff. So it's just, that's how you know, like we don't write for, if we don't want to write a scene and then have it suck.
No. Yeah.
And so if we think it's going to suck, we're not going to write it. You know? We only write it if we think it's going to be good.
I love how Dax has evolved and the different sides of Dax that we've gotten to see already in the first couple seasons.
Yeah, me too.
Chris Brenner takes Dax up to his beautiful office building, which is that two-story fake high rise on the back lot that really doesn't go very high. But they head over to that Citibank building or something is what it looks like to me. We're back in the transporter room, Miles and Kira trying to figure out the problem. What happened? They definitely materialize somewhere. We learn in this scene the cloaking device that uses chroniton particles that create a small variance somehow. And then Miles sees this brief temporal fluctuation happened at the very same time that the transport and the chroniton particles. So they've got a clue, but they don't really know what it means at the end of this scene. But they're starting to find some breadcrumbs here. Starting to try to figure it out.
Have they realized that they don't know when?
They don't even know that there's not time travel yet.
They don't even know it's time travel. They're just like, what's happening?
Something weird happened. Gotta figure it out. It's a very simple sci-fi mystery that probably has one too many scenes of them figuring it out.
I don't know. No.
Well, sometimes isn't it? Do you kind of lose perspective when you're writing it and then can see it when it's done on the screen?
I think it's just, you know, 30 years later, looking at it going like, right, you know, oh, we could have paced this up a little bit. You know?
Yeah.
The pace of this episode in 95 when it came on was pretty typical. So it wasn't like we were dragging back then.
No.
It was pretty pacey, actually. But watching it now, I'm like, oh, man, I can pace this up.
Speaking of different times, do you remember back in the 90s getting a lot of like studio or network notes on things? Like nowadays, often the most common notes that scripts will get are, we need to explain this more. Like, can you have the characters explain that? Like, this is a situation where chroniton particles and temporal variance and all that could have been potentially a network note. Like, hey, you need to explain Do you remember that, or did the network and studio kind of leave you guys alone on DS9?
Back then, yeah, we didn't get notes. We only got notes from Rick.
Oh, wow.
But I don't know if Rick was getting notes from other people. So, and they were a lot of like, explain this more,
that's,
make it clearer. Yeah. Like, so the, you know, they were what they were. I mean, the good thing was you only got notes from one person, and once he signed off, it was done. But the sort of like, do we really have to explain this? Really, guys? I mean, those kind of scenes. And I think Star Trek's particular, like Rick really enjoyed those kind of like sci-fi mysteries.
Yeah.
And he always wanted us to sort of
more of that.
More of that. And we always wanted to do less. Yes. Like, you know, I'm watching that scene now going like, what's that? Just scene.
Yeah, because sci-fi fans are with you.
Yeah. And I also think like at the end of the day, Deep Space Nine wasn't so much of a sci-fi mystery show as Next Generation and Voyager could be. We didn't really do those. We were much more about politics and personal relationships and moral dilemmas and action, actually, than we were about
big sci-fi
weird sci-fi concepts. Yeah. Like, we were like, we have a sci-fi concept that will get us into this really cool story about our characters. Let's get there as quickly as possible and do as little of the sci-fi stuff as we could. And that was just a different difference in tone between us and our contemporary shows. And Rick was a champion of that tone. And so we were always having to do a little more of it than we probably would have wanted.
And also for the viewers, we didn't have a network. We just had the studio.
Mm. Yeah.
So if Rick got notes, it would have been from the studio heads, Kerry McCluggage
and whatnot,
but not, we didn't have a traditional network.
Right. That's
like
that's
you guys did.
Yeah. Yeah. So O'Brien and Kira are kind of getting some hints, but they can't figure it out. We go back down to 2024. We're by a sanctuary main gate, this big wall that must have been installed out in the back lot. We see some tenements. I have to say, this episode had more background actors than I have ever seen on any Star Trek episode. It was huge.
It was a lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
You know, it just occurred to me. You had so many background actors out on the streets and stuff, which was probably way over budget. But in Chris Brenner's office, whenever that door opened, nobody was out there.
We didn't have too much.
Nobody. I was like, this is the most powerful man in media, and there's not like a staff outside.
There is. You just can't see them.
You can't see them. And that's okay. Because I was super happy not to be in that encampment.
Yes, I bet you were.
At the moment, I thought, I'm missing out on the action.
No, but you weren't.
No, it was cold then. Do you remember that,
cold.
Robert?
Yeah,
it was cold. Really cold.
All right, so we see this big gate. Sisko and Bashir are kind of talking off to the side between themselves. They're trying to figure out what happened. They are in San Francisco, but not in the right timeline, clearly. And they think Dax must have been nearby where they woke up. And Sisko does say, we got to find Dax. We got to find a way home. And then our buddy Vin comes over to escort them inside the gates of the sanctuary district. By the way, Robert, so when you transport normally, you just transport, you're there, you're conscious, and you continue with your life. But when you transport through time, it knocks you out, right?
Apparently so.
At least in this episode.
It puts you to sleep.
In this episode, yes.
Okay.
But Bashir says it was a transport sickness or something. He has some medical term for it. Like, you had a rough transport. That's why we got knocked out. It was a little rough.
Like altitude sickness.
Yeah, sure.
I think because the conversation right before they beamed was about Dozer Drazman, about how sleepy he is. So that was in their minds. So
there you go.
Yes, that's the last thing they thought about. So they actually arrived asleep, just like they were thinking about Drazman.
Nice.
So.
Nice.
The one thing that I do like as far as sci-fi nonsense in this episode is that they don't travel in space at all. They actually arrive exactly where they're supposed to.
Yeah,
they do beam down basically to Starfleet headquarters,
right? Which is not there, but that's
not there yet.
Not there yet.
Too soon.
It hasn't been built yet.
Right.
O'Brien gets them to the place.
Right location, wrong time.
Wrong time.
Little okay. Timey-wimey, but other than that.
Well, they walk inside the gate through the wall. It's basically a giant homeless camp. And Bashir, we start to see how horrified he is by all this. He just doesn't understand it. Sisko does know some of this history, and he explains that these districts were in every city on Earth, that these sanctuaries. I like the nice name you give these prisons. It's a sanctuary. Even Chris Brenner later on says, oh, they're probably fine if they're in a sanctuary because they get food. They're so nice there. Yeah. Classic.
Yeah. A billionaire that would never even experience a grocery store.
Yeah.
Well, that term sanctuary comes up later in a different show. Sanctuary is in Walking Dead. So I wonder if those writers were watching this episode.
Well, it's also from, to be fair, it's also from Logan's Run, right?
Oh, that's right. Oh, so maybe it's a Logan's Run reference.
He's trying to find sanctuary.
That's right.
The place where people who are going to be murdered when they turn 30 can live out their lives.
Oh,
right?
My word.
That's right.
There's a very famous line from Logan's Run, which is there is no sanctuary.
That's in here too.
No, but the idea basically that the sanctuary is inherently a lie. Like in Logan's Run, it's a lie. It's a lie in our episode. And I'm pretty sure it's a lie in Walking Dead too. So
yeah, got it.
We're all riffing off the same thing.
Yeah, but they walk through the slum. Sisko explains that these were very common and it's for people that don't have jobs or homes. That's all. Right. That's the crime they've committed. They just don't have a job or a place to live. And then Vin tells Bernardo, who's been complaining about getting home, not working overtime. He's like, Vin says, Bernardo, get out of here. Go home if you want. So Bernardo's very happy at the end of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now we cut up to Chris's office. And Dax is using a computer out of, it did not look 2024. For sure.
That was a swing and a miss.
Yeah. That was like a rental from the
mid-century
prop store. Yeah. It didn't even look. That was.
It looked like what was in the office. Like with what Christine had in the office.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was slimmer than the desktops that we had.
Was it?
Yeah. It is. But, but you need a pen to operate the touchscreen. It was not. Yeah, we didn't. The computer's not great.
the touchscreen and the thing. Yeah. But she's working on the computer and Chris comes in. She tells him that she's ordered a new transit pass. She thanks Chris. He has a few questions about her tattoos. Well, he doesn't know what they are at first. He's like, I really like your, and then she jumps in as usual. Dax covers very well, talks about her tattoos. He mentions he had one, but he had to get it removed for work.
So we bond over tattoos.
Over tattoos, yes.
Yes, I think that's genius.
It's genius.
It is,
yeah.
When this scene first started, just looking at his office / apartment, whatever you want to call it, I was sitting there thinking, this looks so darn familiar. And sure enough, after looking at notes, this is the same set. It was reused in Non Sequitur, the episode where Harry Kim goes back to San Francisco. He's in his apartment. This is Harry's apartment. It's the same set.
So exactly. Funny.
Exactly. So I thought that was pretty cool.
It's part of the, it's part of the canon of Star Trek that Chris Brenner's office was then renovated into condos where Harry Kim lives later on.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I think that has to be true now, right?
Yeah.
You made it so.
It went from the Bryn Man to the Kim Man is what happened. Okay.
So then we built it and you used it?
Is that right? Afterwards. You guys built it and they reused it for my set. I got it. Okay. I'm okay with sloppy seconds. I'm fine with the fact that I have a used set. I'm okay.
We did that infrequently, but we did do that back in the day where we would trade sets sometimes with the other shows. It wasn't common, but every once in a while we would, like, someone would use our cave set or we would use Next Generation's cave set back in the day. There was like a village that they built for a Next Generation episode that we repurposed for Deep Space Nine. So we did do a little bit of resource sharing back then.
Speaking of resource sharing, and we haven't gotten to the scene yet, but there's a scene with like the party where Chris Brenner and all the rich people are having a cocktail party. That felt like it was filmed in our mess hall, or what was 10 forward and then became our mess hall.
Might have been. I have no idea. I don't know.
I was looking at that scene, and we'll get to it later, but I was looking at it going, God, the angle, the windows, the shape, everything about the walls at either end.
Yeah.
It felt like it was what became our mess hall, but was originally next to 10 forward. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very possible.
Yeah. Well, they talk a little more. She doesn't know who he is or what he does. He reveals that he's a very famous man, Brenner Information Systems, among many other things. Mm-hmm. But I just think Dax is a great liar, a great con woman. You just play along so beautifully. It's frightening, Terry. Now that I've seen you do it on the show, I'm like, wait a minute, is she playing me now?
She's a chameleon.
No, I can't do it in real life. I'm a bad liar, but hopefully I'm a better actor.
Dax is really good.
Yeah.
He wonders how she's going to find her friends. And at the end of the scene, she does not know. I think he says, these friends of yours you told me about, is there a way that you could get hold of them? And she doesn't really know. She said, I wish I could. But you still have your brooch, right, Terry?
Yes, I still have my communicator.
AKA.
But I have already tried. And there's no response, right? So,
yeah.
It's not looking good.
The show would be very short if I could find them quickly, so it wouldn't work, right? It would be
quick episode.
Yeah, yes. Very quick.
So we're back at the processing center with Cisco. He's having his palm print scanned, his retinal scan done. That flash of light when it scanned him,
yeah.
I saw Avery was like, that felt real to me. I felt like Avery had just been blinded. They're looking up his records, actor. I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. It's also interesting to note that nowadays it's very normal to get your fingerprint or your eye scanned in order to, you know, if you're traveling, if you go through Clear, if you're using Clear, they ask you, do you want a retinal scan or a fingerprint scan? So all of this stuff that we're seeing on Trek now in the 90s is now real life.
Commonplace.
So, commonplace.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was totally not.
Not in 95, but
that one we got right. That one we kind of got right.
Definitely. Yeah, there's a lot of things you got right.
He gets all these records scanned and stuff, and then they look it up, but Vin checks his records, can't find anything. Mm-mm. It's like he doesn't exist. So he gives him some clipboards with some paper, good old fashioned paper forms to fill out. He's quite rude to them.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of, you know, I like the sort of DMV. It feels like a classic. You're going to get your license renewed and people are just dismissive and rude. And
well,
if you've got any problems, don't come to me with them.
Yeah. Vin's rude, but because Dick Miller is a face that we're all so used to seeing on TV and we love him, it's hard for us to buy his. I'm sitting there going, it's okay if he's rude. It's Dick Miller.
It's all right. He's charming. Exactly.
Yeah, I actually expect him to be rude.
Yeah. Well, if that's Dick Miller were nice to you, then
kind of famous. Yeah. Then you should be worried.
Suspicious. We go back to the bridge on the Defiant. Kira has told Starfleet that no one should beam onto the ship until they know what's happened. Mm-hmm. Miles comes in with some information that this microscopic singularity had passed through the solar system near them just at the moment that they were transporting everybody, and it interacted with the chronoton particles on the hull. So that's what created this temporal polarization, and it basically changed the beam out. So they did complete a transport.
Yes.
But Miles doesn't know when they landed, in what timeline. It could have been any timeline.
But they know it's Sam Friend.
The studio has their explanation.
Yes. Yes. There you go.
One thing I'm kind of like weirdly proud of rewatching this is that this is, it's a black swan event, essentially. Like the thing that happens to transport them is a series of little weird, unpredictable things. Starfleet doesn't usually use cloaking devices. The Defiance, one of their only ships with a cloaking device. Mm-hmm. They don't. So now, it builds up chronic problems. The Defiant also has ablative armor, which no other Starfleet ship has,
right.
Which interacts with it. And then there's a singularity. So yeah. like, it's basically just like a series of unforeseeable events that all sort of like real
combined. Yeah. Individually, none mm-hmm. of those things would have affected anything, but combined.
Yeah.
Is what the key is there. Yeah.
So I actually thought I rewatching like, hey, that's pretty fun. That this is yeah. like, it's not, it's just such a weird combination of strange events that actually mm-hmm. created this situation.
Yeah. Robert, that just reminds me of Thanksgiving when I was a kid. My uncle out of the blue says, you know, if you eat crab meat, kiwi, and drink champagne, you die immediately. And I'm like, that's kind of what this episode is all about. It's only these really random things.
Have you ever tested the theory?
Hell yet? No. I'm not going to test my uncle's theory. I don't know how he came
about that. Sounds delicious, that. By yeah. the way. Like crab and a
crab
kiwi,
meat, kiwi,
kiwi and champagne, champagne sauce. Yeah. You could do like a little... Maybe some rice or couscous.
Yeah, sure. Good. A little broccolini on the side.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would eat those things together.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds delicious. So O'Brien's figured out all this weird combination is what's caused this.
Right.
And it's a time problem. That's what they've discovered in this scene. It's a timeline problem.
Right.
Back in the processing center, we cut in to see a man doodling on Cisco's pants leg.
And I love this.
I
it's
love
so
this
sweet
quirky little detail. And Avery is so kind and gentle yes. with him,
he is.
The way he takes his hand.
Yeah.
And it goes back to what you were saying, Robert, about what happened in the 1980s in the United States with the changing of policies that affect mentally, you know, people with mental illness. Mm-hmm. And it led to a lot of homeless people in the United States in the 80s and 90s mm-hmm. that could have used the help of a mental health facility.
Yeah, they needed care, real care.
Yeah.
My wife at the time worked at a place that treated the homeless mentally ill.
Oh really?
Yeah, she's a psychotherapist. And that's where she was working, a place in the San Fernando Valley. And so that's where a lot of the inspiration for the story came from.
Wow.
Was her dealing with people who were just having a really tough time mm-hmm. of it and probably needed to be. I mean, look, institutionalizing people wasn't great either, obviously. There was a lot of abuse in the institutional systems.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's one of those problems that has persisted because it is hard. You know,
mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, Cisco is very gentle to this person. Yeah. I think both because he has the Federation perspective, and also because, and that's also the reason he doesn't rise to the bait early on from BC is because he knows he cannot change this timeline. He cannot mess with people. Yeah. He's got to.
He can't interact.
Minimally impact as anything. Much as possible. He can't help people. He can't hurt people. He has to like try to. Trod this very gentle path and not step on any stray butterflies, you know?
And it's truly his North Star. And you guys made sure that he stuck with that. I mean, it's repeated over and over again that he has that as his main focus.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting side non sequitur, but there is a psychotherapist for the New Zealand Federal Penitentiary that when she counsels all the inmates, the new inmates, she finds out all the issues that they're dealing with from their, you know, whatever, put them to prison, and she finds the corresponding Star Trek episode that deals with that and makes them watch that as therapy. So
isn't that cool?
That's pretty
cool. You brought
cool.
that up before.
I did, yeah, but cool Robert thing. Doesn't know it, so I just wanted him to know that. It's pretty
very
cool.
Cool.
Yeah. Very cool. All well, right. Bashir's here. We cut from the doodling with Cisco to Bashir, very frustrated. They've been there for hours.
Yeah.
The line's barely moved, and Vin could care less. Again, very DMV of him. Bashir sits down by Cisco, says some of these people need mental health, as we're talking about. He's picking up on this. He's observing this, and it seems so clear to him that these people need medical help. And Cisco looks up and sees the date on like a digital clock. He sees the time, the date, the year, and he puts it together with the history he knows about the Bell Riots, which he explains to Bashir is one of the most violent episodes in U.S. history, and it's going to happen in 4 days right here. They need to get out of here. So that's where that new information comes out.
And they can't do anything to change that. That event needs to happen. He's clear about that too.
I want to say, like, Cisco looks at a date and a time, and he's able to pull this out of his head. I don't know if I could pull any major event in our history. There's very few.
I think it's been established that Cisco is a history buff. So I feel like, you know, these dates and times are not.
They come to him.
Yeah, they come to him much easier than others.
He's much smarter than me, Garrett. Wow. He's much, much smarter than me.
Okay. Well, that's what he's curious about. Yeah, so yes. If it's something that you're interested in, curious about, you'd remember them better.
By the way, sidebar, Rebecca, my wife, teases me all the time because whenever we're traveling anywhere and I see those historical markers on the side of the road, I pull over. I'm obsessed with like historical.
I like them.
I do too.
I you pull over to do what, Robbie? To just
read the thing.
I look around. Yeah. I imagine this event happening here.
Oh, yes.
I will literally pull off the road if I see one up ahead.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I love seeing them on buildings.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, this when historical it says
this
plaque.
Was an old,
yes.
Whatever it was, an old bank built in 18 something.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. All right. Well,
Cisco's a history buff too. All right. We come back after a commercial break from the old days. We did commercials. We come back with Cisco now explaining the Bell Riots. Basically, the Bell Riots were named after this man, Gabriel Bell. He was one of the sanctuary residents who was guarding hostages that were taken during the riots. Some of the police were taken hostage, and the government troops stormed the place based on rumors the hostages had been killed, but it turns out that they weren't harmed at all because Gabriel Bell was a good guy, took care of them. And Cisco explains Bell sacrificed his own life to save them, and he was a national hero. Mm-hmm. And this changed everything, changed all the public opinion about the sanctuaries. And after that, they were torn down, and that's when these social issues started getting corrected. So a lot of history of how important this is. You know, just describing this, Robert, I realized Bell sacrifices his own life. I didn't catch that in the watching, but now having finished this first episode, I'm like, oh, how's that going to work out? Yeah.
Stakes and stuff.
Yeah, stakes
and stuff.
Yeah, stakes and stuff. It was just in Cisco's description, went right over my head, that detail. But now, reconsidering it, knowing how this episode ends, Bell's going to sacrifice his own life. I can't wait to see what happens. Okay.
This is the first scene, though, that Starfleet's temporal displacement policy is ever mentioned in Star Trek. Mm-hmm. They do talk about it in Voyager as well, I do believe. So we have the first appearance of that idea in this scene, in this episode.
Basically, it's a prime directive with time.
Mm-hmm. Basically,
like, that's right. Don't mess up time.
Yeah.
Stay out of time.
avoid creating parallel timelines or destroying the main timeline. Yeah,
exactly.
At all possible when time travel.
Right. A la City on the Edge of Forever. We don't want that to happen.
Exactly.
Okay.
Don't do that.
They get through all this, and Vin comes over and says that they are next. So they head over to a cubicle with a new woman we meet, Lee. Mm-hmm. And she's processing them. She apologizes. She thought they were dims. And this is the first I think we hear. Well, no, it's not the first we hear of it, but she's going to explain it.
Yeah.
She says, oh, I thought you were dims, but you're not. You're gimmies, which I love. And then she says, I think that slang is demeaning and rude. But then she continues to use it, which I think is hilarious.
Right.
Like, well, that's what everybody's doing. So I'll do it, but I don't like it.
But that's also very 90s habit. Too.
Yeah. Yes.
It's a bad habit that she has of using those terms when she shouldn't.
When she shouldn't.
Huh.
But she does explain that since they don't have any jobs or a place to live, that they can stay here in this beautiful sanctuary. And she gives them some food cards, warns them about the guards, says they can be kind of rough. And she brings up ghosts for the first time, which are other residents that, you know, steal and... they just haven't integrated very well.
Robert, so gimmies, as explained, people are looking for help, job, place to live, give me something. Dim, can you explain dims are the people that need to be in a mental hospital or a hospital, but how
people
did you
who
get
have
dim?
Issues, yeah, that they're dim bulbs, unfortunately, that they
dim
are
bulbs.
Not.
Oh.
Dim bulbs.
Dim bulbs, B-U-L-B-S, okay.
Yeah, light bulbs.
As opposed to being a bright bulb.
Oh,
yeah.
Not the brightest bulb in the.
Thank you.
Basically.
Got it.
And why did you use ghost?
The people who just fall through the cracks, that don't fit in, that don't want to fit in.
Okay.
You know, in my wife's experience, there are, you know, look, there are the vast majority of people who experience homelessness want not to be there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people who are mentally ill and aren't able to really function enough mm-hmm. to get themselves out of the situation. And then there are, unfortunately, people that she experienced who just prefer that.
Yeah.
As their lifestyle, it's mm-hmm. just, you know, they have a very low financial responsibility and they can spend their money on things that they want to spend their money on.
Yeah.
And they are tend to be more the more criminal.
And they kind of they kind of prey on these other vulnerable people.
That's the sad thing is bullies. That a lot of the people who, you know, are homelessness, people who are experiencing homelessness often are preyed on by other people experiencing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's sad. Because as Bashir says later on, they're kind of forgotten. They're just forgotten about by the mm-hmm. rest of society. So they're easy prey.
And it's also like, unfortunately, you know, the police tend to not care as much.
Yeah.
When mm-hmm. the victim is experiencing homelessness.
Right.
It's, you know, as I have heard cops say, it's crime on crime in their minds. It's like,
right. That,
you know, there's not a civilian who's the victim. And so they don't care as much.
Wow.
It's a bad attitude and very sad, but it's real.
Well, I love that you bring it up, that you bring up these very important issues in this episode, in the writing of the episode. It's very well articulated and really laid out in a great way.
Thanks.
So they decide to go look for a place to live in the sanctuary for the time being. And then we cut back to Chris's office. Dax is trying her comm badge or brooch, as she's told Chris. her fancy brooch. Can't reach Cisco or Bashir. Chris comes in the door. This is the door moment where I was like, oh my God, he's opening a door. Like it's getting my attention. Yes.
And two friends, apparently.
Exactly. I'm one of them.
Yes. Three. Now he has three friends.
Now he has three friends. But he does tell Dax that he's gotten her a room for five nights at the Clift. Sounds very fancy to me.
Yeah.
Clift.
I like it.
He did check on her friends. He lets Dax know he looked for her friends. No luck yet. And this is when he invites her to for a get together, like cocktail party or something. And he says, you can bring your friends if you find them. They're welcome too. And wishes her luck. And she takes off.
Well, and off camera, you don't see this. He gives me his platinum card.
to go shopping.
To go shopping.
And go to the
go
salon.
Shopping. And I'm assuming he's paying for my room because I don't have any money.
Yes.
I'm not 100% sure whether you got his platinum card or whether Dax, remember, Dax convinces the computer system that she exists.
Oh, that she exists.
And I'm not entirely, I think Dax may have also convinced the computer system that Dax has a platinum card.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. I actually, after that scene, I was thinking, I really would love to know what she said.
Yeah.
And that probably would have been so hard to write. Like, holy cow. When you convince
she's an identity.
Literally, honestly, she hacked. She was a hacker. I mean,
she's a hacker.
She hacked
exactly.
it.
She hacked the system. And that, but we didn't go into any of that. But basically,
that's another episode.
Yeah.
And also, like, hacking is really crappy on screen. It's not very dramatic. The idea that Dax could, like, be displaced in time, get on a computer that she's never used before, figure out the operating system well enough to exploit it, give herself an identity, probably give herself a credit card. It's like, yeah, of course Dax can do that.
Of course she can.
Well, I'm 350 years old,
yeah,
too.
You're very old.
So I was probably alive during that time.
Exactly.
Yeah, you could have been.
Oh, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me on the other hand, I have a Mac is what I use. And, And if I get on a Windows computer, I don't know what the hell to do.
You're lost.
I'm totally lost. I'm like, what is this bar at the bottom? I don't know. Double right click? I have no idea. So
the name for this swanky hotel, the Clift, is that named after Montgomery Clift? Is that?
I believe that was, yeah, I think so.
That was the.
Oh. But also there's I grew up in San Francisco. There's a place called the Cliff House.
Uh-huh. Right. Cliff House, though, right? Without a T.
Yeah, so it's a little bit the Cliff House. Yeah. It's a little bit inspired
but
by
fancy.
That.
Fancy.
Yeah.
But
yeah, well, it the Cliff House itself is just a restaurant and like a tourist trap, basically.
Okay.
It's not a hotel at all, but it used to be bigger and fancier. And so I was kind of imagining that.
It's like Gladstone's out of Malibu. Right?
Okay. Yeah.
It's like that.
Oh, no.
Sounds fancy, but
everybody
it's really
has to go
a bunch
when they
of
first
tourists
move there. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I went there the first time I came to LA. I went to Gladstone.
Yes. Me too.
Yeah. We go back to the Sanctuary District and Cisco and Bashir are looking for a place to stay. They get to an apartment building, but they're turned away by some rough looking dudes. They won't let them come in. Look for somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And Bashir cannot understand the lack of compassion and care that people, you know, that people don't have for all these people stuck in the sanctuary. This is the scene, I thought, Robert, where you really dove into, through Bashir's, you know, experience of it, these issues in a really great way. I particularly love the line, I highlighted it here, where Bashir says, he says, causing people to suffer because you hate them is terrible, but causing people to suffer because you've forgotten how to care, that's really hard to understand. I love that line. It's beautiful. It's a great line.
There's a lot
it
of
really
character.
Is.
Yeah, a lot of character development for Bashir in this episode. And this is the first time he really stands up for something. He's worked up. You know, we don't see a worked up Bashir until this episode, I feel. He's very into what's happening around him.
Yeah.
I think this was kind of, I wouldn't say the culmination of his character arc, from sort of the callow and sort of narcissistic spectrum-y dude he was at the beginning of the show.
Silver Spoon kind of guy, in a way.
In a way, I mean, we'll eventually learn some things about him that
don't
undermine
tell us.
Some of that. We won't tell you.
Yeah.
But it's the first, he's sort of emerging as a heroic figure. He's becoming the person he imagined he was at the beginning, in a way, a better version even of that person, someone who really does care, who really is trying to help people, who really does have a tremendous amount of empathy and is physically courageous and all of those things, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, this is sort of a big episode in the sort of arc of Bashir growing up.
Is this the first time that that Cisco and Bashir are off together? That doesn't happen very often.
Might be.
Does it
doesn't happen very often. I'm trying to remember.
You're right, Terry.
Oh, yeah.
They're a good team. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is a sort of mentorship.
Yeah.
Relationship between the two of them.
Yeah. That comes through.
Well, I love this conversation as they're walking through, seeing all of this sad situation with everyone. And they come upon this man who's getting beaten up. I swear it was Dennis Matalone taking the punch. Dennis Matalone.
Stunt coordinator extraordinary.
Oh, most certainly.
Yeah, with the big head snap and the fall to the ground. But there was never a close-up of him on the ground, so I'm not sure, but I think it was Dennis.
And if not him, Tom Morga. So.
Yeah, no, it was
well,
Dennis.
There's no close up. That's usually it. Probably was Dennis.
Probably.
And I think, you know, Dennis had long hair.
Yeah.
And I think whoever was getting beaten up, it almost looked like someone that tucked the hair, tied it up under, or done some weird, you know, hairdo to hide his long hair. But anyway, he gets beaten up. This is where we meet BC, who's one of the ghosts. Clearly is behaving like the lead described ghost.
Oh, he's so icky.
He is icky, but you know, it's cool that you know to stay away from the ghosts because all ghosts wear hats. It's very clear.
Cowboy
if you're a bad guy, you wear a hat, a fedora in the episode. That's what's happening. It's a hat gang. Yeah.
He had a nice hat. I'm a hat guy. I liked his hat.
It's a nice hat. Yeah.
It was a nice hat.
The status symbol.
Creepy
in the
guy,
sanctuary.
Nice hat.
Yeah.
Creepy guy.
Creepy guy, nice hat.
Yeah.
Wait, I just realized you're both wearing hats, so clearly you're ghosts.
Yes, clearly we're ghosts.
We are. We're a gang.
You're not, though, Robert.
No, yeah. No, we're the good guys because we're the good guys. The
are you?
People,
are you gimmies? You're gimmies then, right?
We're either gimmies or dims.
Oh my god. Oh, we're funny. Gimmies. You guys are dims. Yeah.
We're, yeah, dims. We're dims. You're gimmies.
Sorry.
We're dim ghosts.
I'm definitely dim bulbs.
Oh my goodness.
BC doesn't recognize them. You know, Bashir and Sisko don't know exactly how to handle this, but Sisko decides they're just gonna leave because of this timeline issue. He doesn't want to get involved. We can't help. We can't hurt. We just need to stay out of it. So they move on.
Frank Military did a great job with that character, I thought, by the way. And
yeah, he did.
Subsequently, he moved away from acting and he became a TV writer. And I think he wrote a lot of Law and Order, actually. Since
did he really?
Oh, what? That's amazing.
I have to look at his credits. But yeah, he pivoted into writing and has had a really great writing career.
Oh, wow.
Then.
Oh, that's
he was
so
already
great.
I think he might have already been writing a bit at the time.
Yeah.
But he definitely writes much more now than he acts.
Than he acts.
Mm-hmm.
NCIS Los Angeles. Like, yeah, he's Jericho. He's got some pretty good credits.
Oh, wow.
Good for him.
A bunch of NCIS stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very cool.
We go to the bridge next. The team is working on, you know, finding them. Miles has found about a dozen different timeline possibilities, but they only have enough of this chronoton particle stuff for 5 or 6 attempts. Hmm. And Kira says they're going to need volunteers who are willing to get lost in time. Miles says he knows exactly who the candidates. So you can tell they're going to be the ones. They're volunteering.
Of course, we have to have more heroes in Jeopardy. Of
yes,
course.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Stakes. It's all about the stakes.
Stakes, yeah. And stuff. Stakes and stuff.
Exactly. And
we went from medium rare to close to well done.
Close to well done right now. Yeah.
We go to the sanctuary. We're in an alley next where our heroes have been sleeping and kind of, I don't know if it's an alley. It's like a basement
alcove
or something. Yeah, but Sisko brings Bashir some food, some breakfast. Sisko says he wants to go on a roof to get a better look at the place. Maybe they can find a way out from a vantage point up high. Back onto the main part of the street. This is the widest shot. I think it's this shot that I have behind me. is this next shot, because when I looked at that shot, I was like, wow, that's a lot of extras, background actors, a lot of set dressing. That's big for our Star Trek
costumes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was
hair and makeup. That's a
that
lot.
Is a money shot. That is probably one of the most expensive shots we ever did.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
It is.
And it's so funny, I wouldn't imagine the audience really pick up on those costs, but we do.
No.
Yes.
From being in it. Yeah.
Yeah. I loved it. It was beautiful, great production value. And the guards that are guarding the building, they had passed that same building. They tell them no again, you know, keep moving. Bashir offers to trade them something and they refuse initially. And then as they're walking away, one of the guard guys whispers to the other one and the guard says, wait a minute, maybe we can make a deal. I was like, what are they gonna, it didn't make any sense to me. Then
neither.
We see in the next scene, they wanted those fancy pajamas they were wearing, their uniforms. Sisko and Bashir are now in the homeless kind of clothes, you know, street clothes. They come across this boy who's injured and his father, who's got a knife to protect his son. He says, stay back. Bashir wants to look at him, though. He's very concerned. Sisko doesn't want to get involved. Sisko's like, ugh. Julian says, I'm just going to look. I'm not going to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Julian looks. He says, luckily, it seems like he's just got superficial wounds, nothing serious. Mm-hmm. And the dad, who we learn his name is Webb, goes to get some alcohol to clean these cuts. That's what Bashir suggests. And looks like they've made some new friends, Sisko says. So,
yeah.
It seems like they've met some nice people.
Right.
Even though they're wearing smelly clothes.
And look, Webb and his son are supposed to represent sort of the the everyman, the vast majority of the people who get stuck in this situation.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
We were trying to imagine the idea of like the circumstances were sort of more like Great Depression was what we're kind of imagining, that there is some sort of like vast, or you know, kind of new Gilded Age too. Like mm-hmm. the rich are very, very rich. The poor are very, very poor. There are less like jobs like now.
Come on. Yeah. So, like now. 100%.
And that was the idea, was there was some sort of massive amounts of unemployment. You know, like now, actually, our unemployment is fairly low, but
yeah,
whether the jobs are good or not is another argument. But right. we were imagining like 20-30% unemployment, like really, really high.
Oh, right.
And that was what Webb was caught up in.
Okay. And most people live check to check.
Nowadays, for sure.
Nowadays, yeah. yeah.
And so you have one bad month or mm-hmm. miss
a medical crisis or whatever.
Exactly. And you could be homeless.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, that's what it feels like. Yes, with Webb and his son, it feels like the everyman. It feels like these aren't people you would expect would be in the situation, and they've mm-hmm. gotten caught.
He
up
didn't do anything wrong.
Correct.
Life just happened and put him in this circumstance.
That's the idea. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Well, as Bashir and Cisco are walking out, Webb chases them outside. He says they need more doctors here. In the sanctuary, Bashir declines. Webb tells them, you know, you're never going to get out of here. This is home for you guys now. And if you want to survive, you're going to need to organize, pull together. And Cisco's like, no, we don't want to be a part of anything. Want to just be left alone. Mm-hmm. And Webb says, well, if you change your mind, you know where to find me. So it feels like Webb is some of that history Cisco was talking about, this kind of getting organized, you know, having an uprising. It feels like Webb is kind of the crack into that part of the history that Cisco remembers. Next scene is in Chris's office. This is party time. Dax has been shopping with her platinum card. She's got a new hairdo. This is where I thought it looked like this scene looked like our mess hall.
But
I
it's
feel like it was readdressed.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Because the way the angles, it looked like ship windows. They weren't building windows that went up and down. They sort of curved like a ship.
All right. That makes sense. I have to look at that again. Yeah. I didn't notice that.
This is 2024 fashion, Terry, that you're wearing. I didn't know that I should be wearing the look that you have in this episode.
I like what I'm wearing.
It's very nice.
Even more now than then.
Yeah.
First of all, I'm in a mini skirt, which is like, I'm sure at the time, I know me, I would have thought, oh my God, I can't believe I'm wearing this short mini skirt.
With a jacket. It sort of had like a men's tailored jacket and like
I liked
ascot
how Bob
thing.
Did the tie.
Yeah.
The tie across. It was a cool different look.
Bob definitely, you can tell that Bob got excited about the the high fashion, but also like the street stuff that the people were wearing. Like he was definitely like on his best in this game. I've seen
Hog Heaven.
Yeah, and I've definitely seen people enjoy cosplaying as Dax from this episode specifically.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So they can wear that outfit and feather and the whole thing.
And I don't get to wear heels often.
Do you remember this hairdo, Terry? Because this is a very different hairdo.
This is the one where Josie cut my bangs at 4 in the morning and I was upset about it. This is the one.
Well, this was a very different hairdo, and the bangs thing, you've brought that up before. So it's interesting to see this was the episode.
Yes, that upset me. But I couldn't call Rick because it was 4:30 in the morning. I couldn't call him and go like, she's cutting my bangs.
Yeah. A lot of dichotomy between the scenes in the sanctuary with basically Bashir and Cisco, and a lot of kind of tones of racial inequality in a way. If you look at it, it's just like it's
the rich
so nice.
It's
completely yes, mm-hmm. yes.
This is a rich people's party.
Yeah, it was definitely we were trying for a Gilded Age feel.
Yes.
That was kind of there's a huge disparity.
Great Gatsby kind of vibes.
Yeah, that era. Yeah. You know, late 1800s when 1880s, 1890s were you know, they sometimes say we're in the new Gilded Age now, which, you know, even more so than we were in the 90s. So, yeah, it was that was
I think we are.
Well, they're talking with a man and a woman there. It sounds like protests are happening all over the world. They're kind of chatting about that. Chris does mention that Dax was mugged. And that they took her ID. And that's when I think the woman says, oh, you're lucky that you weren't taken to the sanctuary. Dax hears this. She pulls Chris aside and thinks maybe that's where her friends are. Maybe that's what happened to them. They were taken to a sanctuary because they didn't have any ID either. And Chris says he agrees to help her find out, pull some favors. So Dax is getting a little, some breadcrumbs. Miles and Kira got some bread. It's all starting to come together here.
I think I got more than breadcrumbs.
Yeah, I think
you got way more than breadcrumbs. Yeah, you got a whole sandwich. But we also have the names of these different political parties that Robert's thrown in here. Neo-Trotskyists, the Gaullists, Gaullists, people who love French politics, I guess. I don't know, you know.
But well, they were still specifically, like, they were talking about France, I believe.
Yeah, they were.
Or at least
okay.
Europe. And,
that's right.
It's just, like, the left and the right. Like, it's literally just the Neo-Trotskyists are the far left protesters, and the Gaullists are far right protesters, and that's basically all.
Thank you.
Nice.
I like it.
But Gaul, as in de Gaulle.
Charles yes. de Gaulle.
Charles de Gaulle. Yeah.
We go back to the sanctuary district. They're waiting in a very long line for some food. It's later in the day. Sisko goes to see how long this line. Doesn't seem like they're moving very fast. So Sisko goes to see how long it's going to be. And this is when BC, the ghost, returns. He tries to shake down Bashir, basically. Wants his food card, wants stuff. And Sisko returns, tells BC to let him go. We get into a big fight here. Yeah, lots of great two-handed classic Trek. Boom.
Yes. You know,
lots of Dennis Madelon.
Even felt that way at the beginning with the tone of how it was shot.
Yeah.
The angles, it was like I was like suddenly in the original series for a minute. Yes, you know, just did. Like a short minute like- of, wait a minute.
Their fighting style was so classic Star Trek.
I even
noticed it. I you know, it's been a while since I watched it. I was watching it like, wow, they went to the Jim Kirk dojo. They're just
they totally did.
I was waiting for the composer to put in and it didn't show up.
And Bashir is famous for this now to me.
Yes, he does it all the time.
He needs both hands for a punch.
The double-handed punch. Terrible technique. Does not work at all.
Dennis McCarthy is the composer of the musical score here. This is one of his favorite episodes.
Oh.
Interestingly enough, due to the amount of musical silence, there's only 7 minutes of music in the entire episode. That's it.
Seriously?
Really?
So the fact that there is that much silence is what makes him love this episode so much, and he's the composer for the music.
Very unusual for Trek in general and any TV show back then. There was a lot of over scored and over musicalized stuff, you know, needle drops, constant music.
Right.
So it's nice to have a more theatrical or cinematic kind of style, which is just thinner.
You don't need the music. You just focus on the good writing of our friend Robert here, and we're good.
Well, while they're having this hand-to-hand combat, we see some new man appear, African-American man, sees the fight happening, comes up to try to fight off the ghosts, but he ends up getting stabbed.
Mm-hmm.
And Bashir and Sisko try to do CPR, but they've got to get out of there and run away before the police get to them.
Yeah.
Sisko does grab the man's ID. I noticed that. Cops give chase. Yeah, and then they dive into this other alley, and I have to bring up the fact. So I shot a short film when we were doing Voyager. I talked the John Campbell, who was the studio facilities guy. His office was right by my trailer, and we got to know each other over the years. So he got me the back lot for a weekend for free to shoot a short film, which was incredible. And in fact, he offered that one time. He's like, I think I could get you the back lot if you want to make a short. So I wrote a short specifically to film on the back lot. I was like, that's a huge thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the final moment of my short is in the same spot where they dive under.
The blankets.
Oh, get out.
And I thought I had discovered this, you know, little nook that no one would ever shoot in when I shot my short. And it's here in this episode.
Something to discover.
Yes. But they dive in this the spot, and the cops run past, And this is when Sisko looks at the man's ID. It's Gabriel Bell. Ugh. That man was Gabriel Bell. Dun,
no.
Dun, dun.
No.
Knew it.
Yes.
Knew it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We come back after a commercial break. They realize without Bell, the future's going to be altered. And it was in this moment I'm like, oh, I thought that guy looked a little like Sisko when the guy that didn't speak, I know what's going to happen. Sisko's going to have to do what Bell did because he knows the history. That was my guess at this point.
I didn't think that. But God,
you didn't?
No.
You didn't? Mm-hmm. Didn't.
I've seen some
I think
TV
I've
shows.
Just watched too much television. Yeah. As soon as I saw him, I was like, no, it's got to be him. No.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
Yeah, there's too many times where there's a tell.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's but not you, bad. It's just no. Once you read all these scripts.
It's a great idea, like for yeah. Sisko to have to take over that hero's role. It's a great idea.
Yes.
We go to the bridge next. Kira and O'Brien are in very nice civilian clothes, by the way. They weren't in their uniforms. I don't know where they brought this on the Defiant with them, or did they replicate it?
Replicator.
Yes.
See, and then why, when we were on Meridian, didn't I replicate some clothes to yes. go down to the planet? Why am I constantly in my uniform?
In your uniform.
Why? You could just stop at Y Meridian and you don't have to like that.
Yeah. Well,
Y Meridian.
Yeah. You know? Y Meridian. Well, it would have helped if there was some chemistry between me and the lead guy.
Yeah.
That would have helped.
That would have helped.
A little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. We did 26 a year.
Yes, exactly.
That's right.
Most of them yeah. were good.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Right.
Well, that's a lot, and you guys had no breaks in the summer, so yeah. it's a yeah. lot.
Like it was also just a really, I mean, again, this is very behind the scenes, but it was a physically difficult show to do. There was a lot of the makeup on everybody. The yeah. production was hard. It was our hours were long. Our days
hours were super long. Short long. Schedule. We had 7 days.
Short schedule.
Generally.
Not a lot of time to prep. We had to build everything from scratch.
Yes.
And we had to write, we were writing as fast as we could too. And so it's kind of a small miracle that we have mostly good yes. episodes, to be honest.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
every once in a while, there was one that slipped through the cracks. There's probably like one or two stinkers every year.
I got a lot of really good ones, so I'm not going to complain. Yes, I got a lot of really good ones.
You got a lot of good scenes.
I don't on like 30 good ones and it's on two bad ones for sure. I mean, obviously anytime you have this kind of like what's behind Robbie trying
that
to be really ambitious production values. It was a very tough episode. I mean, there's fire effects, there's fights, there's like giant crowd scenes. It's this was a biggie.
Yeah.
And you had kids in some of these scenes, a lot of these scenes on the street, which there's limited hours for those kids. You've got a schedule around that. I believe we
used a crane. We never used a crane. We never put the camera on a crane and got those because
it took too
not
long.
Unless we were in Huntington Gardens where we live for our outdoor life.
So back on the bridge of the Defiant, essentially they're in these cool outfits. They're ready to beam down. But O'Brien says, Starfleet has changed their minds. Headquarters thinks it's too risky.
Mm-hmm.
We might contaminate the timeline. We can't do this. Kira's like, well, get me Admiral Wright. O'Brien tries, but there's no response. There's nothing. They keep trying, sending messages out, wider messages on subspace wideband, and nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out there's all the different satellite networks that we're used to from Earth, gone. Everything's gone.
Disappeared.
It's completely disappeared. There's nothing there. They start detecting other type of subspace signals, and guess what? They're Romulan. They're not Starfleet. So now it's the big old, hey, what the heck is going on? Something changed in the timeline. Now everything is different.
Yeah. Well, Odo's the one that says it. Doesn't he say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Odo brings that up. Yeah.
You think maybe they altered the timeline somehow?
To the point where there's no Starfleet at this point, which is a bad thing. Yeah.
Was this the same scene where Odo comes in because he was talking to Starfleet security?
Yeah,
and
he was talking to...
Okay. Yeah.
Also in these outfits, one thing I forgot to mention, I noticed right off the top, when Odo comes in, Odo and Kira are standing next to each other and they're totally color coordinated.
That
and
purplish
I was like,
sort of, yeah.
I was it, or green or I don't know what it was, but they look like matchy matchy, the two of them. And I was
like,
she
always wore that vest. She wore that vest a lot.
She did.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was foreshadowing of maybe their relationship, like Odo and Kira. We're going to put them in the same color palette. I don't know. A detail.
Maybe Bob was thinking that. I have no idea. But that vest was like Kira's favorite sweater, basically. She wore it a lot.
Yeah.
And it looked cool on her. She looks really cool in it.
Well, they figure out in the scene, I think, Miles figures out what has happened, because I thought in this scene, Robert, I had the same thought that Miles answers here, which is, wait a minute, if Starfleet disappeared, they wouldn't be here. Like, you know,
they themselves wouldn't be here. The Defiant wouldn't be there.
The Defiant, none of this would be there. And Miles answers the question that the Chronoton particles helped create this subspace bubble around the Defiant.
Thank goodness for that. That was a 3 a.m. idea, I bet.
I'm sure that bubble. Was the tech advisor, like Andre
Bormanis.
Just like, Andre, help us explain this nonsense.
I did write in my notes, I went, I'm skeptical of this scene. I mean, okay, there's a bubble.
Look,
I was like, well, you lost me there.
There's faster than light travel already. Like we're already like,
yeah, true. There's
a buy. You have to buy it.
Okay. Yeah. All right, I'm in. The bubble. It's the bubble. The safety bubble. Just,
the shapeshifter didn't throw you out, but the Chronoton particle bubble did.
Well, we go back to the sanctuary building. Sisko and Bashir tell Webb that they've changed their minds. They want to help. Webb is very happy. He says day after tomorrow, they're going to have a rally in front of the processing center, spread the word, tell everybody. And Webb also says to them, tell everybody to look sharp, dress nicely, and bring their families. Like, we don't want this to look like a bunch of homeless people, basically. We want to look like
yahoos.
You know, we want to look like we take care of ourselves and we deserve, you know, some respect.
Yeah.
So Webb is smart that way. He wants to spin it the way he wants. He wants to be perceived as a person who's struggling, not as some kind of societal pariah or whatever, right? He's a family man who's trying to do what's best for his family.
Mm-hmm. We're in Chris's office, and he has found out, his sources have found out that Dax's friends are in Sanctuary District A. So Dax wants to know, can we just get them out now? It's not that easy. They have to first find them. And there are, I did not know this, there's 10,000 people in this homeless sanctuary. That's a lot more than I thought there were. So I'm a little shocked by that, but that's makes sense. It's a problem. But anyway, so the friends are fine, but they just can't find them right now. They're looking for them still.
This is where Chris says, oh, they're in the sanctuary. They'll be fine. They're getting fed and taken care of. So Chris is like, he has a fantasy of what it's like inside this place.
Totally.
Oh, yeah. And I'm like, well, if that's all there is to it, then why is there a wall around it?
Exactly. Yeah. Why would there be a wall?
Safe, great place to be. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, back inside the wall in the sanctuary, Sisko and Bashir are spreading the word. When Danny, that's Webb's son, the one that was injured, he runs past. He says there's a riot breaking out, that a guard got into a fight with a Dim. Everybody's going crazy. So they run back. Sisko and Bashir run with Danny. And then back at the outside the processing center, there's firebombs being thrown. People are lying in the street. Three people are beating up Bernardo. And
Dick Miller's partner? Is that the same? Yeah, it is Dick's partner.
Vin's partner, the guy with the wife that he kept wanting to go home to.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, Bernardo's wife is going to be pissed off. She's going to be mad.
She's going to be.
He's already thinking he should have just left home when he said he was going to.
Exactly.
Why am I still here?
Well, he did. I think he went home. It's like the next.
It's another day.
Came back. It's another day. He's back, clocked in again.
But he was very nervous about his wife getting his wife mad. So I was just thinking, don't mess with Bernardo. You don't know his wife. Anyway, they grab his gun. They're about to shoot Bernardo with a gun. When Sisko grabs it, he fires.
He shoots that trash can. Is that weird? The fire went out. And I was like, is that really what would have happened?
I don't know, but right? It was cool. I like the fact that he shoot into the air like randomly. He shot at this trash can and like placed his bullet somewhere safe. And like, cool bit. I can't remember. It must have been maybe Reza and Dennis who came up with the choreography of that. I can't remember what was in the script, but I thought that that was a really cool, I liked that it was an unexpected bit of choreography.
Yeah.
In other words, it's like you've seen a million times the guy fire in the air. I've never seen someone fire into a trash can and knock it over and knock the fire out. It was cool.
I expected the fire to go like to blaze out instead of going out. It was like, it was cool.
Didn't really understand it, but I liked it.
Yeah.
After the shotgun gets fired, though, Bashir and Sisko grab Bernardo to drag him away. They drag him into the processing center where BC and some of his ghost friends have taken over the place. BC has a gun. He's roughing up Lee, our very nice woman that was so...
Tina Lifford.
He's roughing her up. And Sisko and Bashir arrive. Sisko aims his gun at BC. He's like, that's enough. Leave that nice lady alone.
Yeah.
And BC allows Sisko to join him, says he's been waiting for this moment. Mm-hmm. And Sisko, he says, he calls him new guy or something, right?
New boy.
New boy. Ain't that right, new boy? And this is Sisko's Bond moment. Mm-hmm. The name is Bell. Gabriel Bell.
Yeah.
And we finished part one. There you go.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The lesson I got out of this episode so far, part one, is that line that I mentioned to you, Robert. I love that line, Bashir's perspective, that forgetting how to care about other people is the most terrible thing there is, basically. That's the lesson I got from this. That'll stick with me. I really, like I said, Robert, love that line.
All right, Terry, what is your lesson for this episode?
Compassion for those who have less than you do, to always pay it forward.
Okay, nice. Great. Robert, is there an overall lesson that we're going to get from you?
He's going to tell us what it really is.
Yeah, exactly, what it really is.
I usually like to be a little less forward with the lesson of the episode, but it's definitely there, and it is exactly what you're saying, Robbie. It is the sort of like, caring is what made the Federation work, right? The fact that people started to care about these people and wanted to help them is what created the Federation. Like, without that caring, without the concern for your fellow humanity, there's no Federation. That's basically the idea.
Rule of Acquisition 217. You can't free a fish from water. That is my biggest lesson from this, because it is so true. You can't
love it.
You can't. That's the fish is naturally in the water. You cannot pull it out. So that's it.
I like
that's
it.
Mine. Thank
it's
you.
It's a good rule.
It is a good rule. Now, our Patreon poll winner for the theme and moral of this episode is submitted by Snazio. A world of the haves and have-nots will never create a functional society.
Yeah, which is, Robert, what you said. Starfleet, a functional Starfleet could only come out of more equality. Great.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's it. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to our recap and discussion of Past Tense, Part 1. Please join us next time when we will be reviewing Past Tense, Part 2 with Terry and Robert Hewitt Wolf. And we want to have a big thank you to Robert for joining us. It's been absolutely a joy to have you. We've absolutely had a blast with you joining us on this time. And you've been so gracious with your time and your insights of this episode. Yeah. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been fun to be here.
Yeah. All right. For all of our Patreon patrons, please stay tuned for your bonus material and a little bit more of Robert Hewitt Wolf and Terry joining us for that.